A cartoonist can't stop himself from commenting on society. That's the point of view of Al Capp, creator of Lil Abner. From Radio Center, the University of Florida in Gainesville, this is Point of View, interviews with captivating personalities. Here to talk with Al Capp is your host, Mark Damon.
By virtue of the work that you do, your daily cartoon, which appears in I don't know how many newspapers.
Now, 1,400.
1,400 in
awful the lot of fish are wrapped in my cartoons the day after.
Well, of course, you can't avoid, and you do this, I know. You do comment to quite an extent, of course, on the society around you, don't you?
Every cartoonist does. The cartoonist, by virtue of the profession itself, can't avoid making comments. For instance, the most non-controversial, non-political, non-satirist cartoonist who ever lived cannot draw a dog or a fence without expressing his attitude toward beasts or architecture in the very way he draws a dog or fence. So that I'm not unique in making comments. All of us do.
Now, does Lil Abner, which of course is your product, I mean, is this solely and really your product? Is there some kind of a brain trust who sits down and thinks up ideas for Lil Abner?
I tell you, often I do get ideas sent to me in the mail, and I have my secretary read them, and if they're any good, she burns them. I don't want anybody. You know, mainly, I don't read them myself because they're no darn good, mostly. More than that, I fear that they may be good. And I know if I don't see the good ones, then I'll think of them.
You don't
in
see.
In a week or two.
You don't see most of them, in other words, do you?
I see none of them.
You see none of them?
No, a comic strip, unless it's the expression of a guy is a board of trustees manufacturing a synthetic product, and it's been tried and it never works.
Now, where do your ideas come from mostly? What is the line of communication between you and society from which you get the ideas to comment on or to criticize on?
I just read the front page, clean it up, and use it in a strip. I certainly don't reproduce life as it is in the comic page. It's not good for children. I idealize politicians and Jack S. Fogbaum, and I romanticize the Iron Curtain countries and Slobovia. I really try to put the best face on everything.
Well, you mentioned children. That brings up a point. I mean, do you aim at a specific segment of an audience?
I figure any kid who reads Lil Abner is a little degenerate. No, Abner is written for the adult. Teenagers.
Teenagers.
Well, it's written for people who are not infants and teenagers who are but can read. But mainly, since it deals with subjects which continue to vex us, it has nothing for children, except sometimes it has some sex and violence and kids like that, but I can't put enough sex and violence in to make it a kid's strip.
You would probably run into censorship anyway, wouldn't you, if this happened?
I never really have. The only time I've ever run into censorship, there's a great legend that surrounds Abner that there are really a lot of all sorts of startling symbols concealed in it, and if you fold it and hold a candle up behind it, oh boy, that doorknob. And I do my best to encourage those legends because it does add a great audience of perverts to my readership. But the truth is that there never is anything in the strip that isn't familiar comedy done as in my own style. The only time I've been censored was by a California editor once who was very anti-Adlai Stevenson. And I drew I had a sequence in Washington. I had Abner ask Stevenson who lived in that house. And he pointed, there's a very pretty house there. Who lives? It was a white house. And Stephen said, well, he said, I plan to move into it, but the same tenant has decided. It was a clumsy little joke, and it was really rather a bad drawing of Stevenson. The editor of the paper was so enraged that I would use his space to do a to draw a picture of Stevenson that he drew great big Victorian side whiskers on Stevenson, which fastened the attention of hundreds of thousands of people on his face who would never have known it was Stevenson before. And so he managed to identify the drawing as Stevenson to people who never would have known it.
Now, in a case like this, was Mr. Stevenson himself aware of this? Did you have to get his permission or something like that?
Oh, certainly not. No,
you don't.
I never. There used to be some uneasiness by my syndicate in the early days of the strip when I did use actual people in it. No one ever objected, but they were afraid someone might. However, now, since clearly I wouldn't use in a strip that appears all over the world and in most languages, in some 1,400 papers, I wouldn't use a face that wasn't recognizable all over the world. And so my very use of a public face is at least my concession that it's a universally known face. And this is so flattering to my victims that no matter how I disembowel them, they're so pleased at this admission of mine that I can predict, for instance, the day after I draw an unforgivable picture of, let's say, Nelson Rockefeller, and make a scandalous reference to him, I can predict the telegram that will come the next day saying, please send me that picture and sign Nelson Rockefeller.
They look upon this as some sort of a commercial, in other words.
Well,
right?
They look at it as
a form of publicity.
Flattery. Alf Landon, who ran for president once, once was part of a really charming episode. I had one of my characters in trouble, and they doubted whether he was a loyal American, and he bared his chest and it said, vote for Alf Landon. It was tattooed on his chest. Well, that proved that he was the best kind of an American. And after that appeared, I got the most enchanting letter from Governor Landon saying that for years he'd been trying to persuade his grandchildren that he was once a man of some importance in this country, and they regard him as just a lying old reprobate. But he said, the morning that appeared, in Little Abner, vote for Alf Landon, the kids had called him and said, gee, Grandpa, you're in Little Abner.
After all, you were right.
Yeah, they thanked me for giving him some status with those brats.
Now, you were talking about politicians, of course, up to this point, but you have portrayed in your cartoon people other than politicians, say. Have you ever been in any kind of trouble or something that might look like trouble in doing this?
I did have a sort of tart, if you'll forgive the expression, a correspondence with Liberace's lawyer. You remember Liberace?
You mean the pianist?
Well, he had a piano, yes. I wouldn't go that far, though. I wouldn't say that he was a talented pianist. He was an adorable pianist. I did have some correspondence with a lawyer of his who said that a character I created called Lover Boynick.
Lover Boynick?
Yes, Lover Boynick resembled Liberace, which I thought was a dreadful thing for him to say about Liberace. And he's going to sue me because of the resemblance, and Time magazine heard about it, possibly because I tipped him off. And they asked me what my defense would be, and I said, my defense would be that Lover Boynick had no resemblance whatever to Liberace, since Lover Boynick could play the piano rather decently. Time published that, and I never heard from the lawyer again. And
no suit?
No. I never heard Liberace again, but that can be managed by almost anyone.
Let's go back a little bit, Mr. Kemp, if we may, to the beginning of all this. I mean, how did you and how did Dogpatch and Little Abner get started? Did you as a boy dream of becoming a cartoonist, for instance?
Yes, I had no ambition whatever. What I wanted to be was a cartoonist. Actually, when I was about 15, I lived in New Haven. I was born and raised in New Haven. I was about 15 years old. And I decided to hitchhike to Memphis, Tennessee, to visit an uncle of mine who had expressed no wish to see me. Now, my geography was very poor. I was sure that you went south as far as Washington, then you crossed a river, and there was the South, and pretty soon
right.
I'd arrive in Memphis, Tennessee. Well, I did about 30 days after I crossed that river. There were no superhighways in. I just slept in the ground. I got lost and in the mountains. Now, at the time, my parents felt that I was a young bum. Later, I referred to this episode as research because, in effect, it was. I then saw the South, really, from the ground up. And a few years later, when I was trying to find in my mind some background for a comic strip that had not yet been used on the comic page, that occurred to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that is how the atmosphere of Dogpatch interested me.
The technical aspect of this, Mr. Krapp, you are an artist. You draw, I suppose, don't you, Al Krapp?
You're darn
you design
right,
the characters, did
yeah.
you? Well, you don't draw them from day to day, do you? Each
I
and
do
every
indeed.
Figure?
Yes,
do
I
you?
Have assistants, but don't ever kid yourself that the artist who signs it isn't on it every day. All that enormous amount of work is designed in its creative stage and carried along quite a bit towards its finish stage by the man who creates it. And when he doesn't, although the public doesn't know he isn't doing it, something goes from the strip and the public stops reading it.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you another question or two about this a little bit later, but first of all, did you have any schooling, any training in this kind of design or drawing?
It wouldn't seem so, looking at my stuff, would it? But it may come as a stunning surprise
Please, yes.
to know that I studied fine arts.
You did?
Yes, indeed. Yes. Well, you see, the fine arts now are considered sort of abstract, as taken. Fine arts isn't all arranging Coca-Cola bottles, although the great masters do that. And then there are other great masters who arrange Scott tissue rolls and get the
pop art. Isn't that called pop art?
Or? Well, it's
I know less about it than you.
Yes, I call it Scott tissue art. But comic drawing is illustration in the traditional sense, but done with whatever humorous attitude the artist has, so that actually on the comic page you'll find drawings more in the tradition of the classic art than in any of the galleries.
You actually did, in other words, go to what? To a college or to a trade?
I went to the
institution
Academy of Fine Arts in Philadelphia, Museum School in Boston, several other schools in Boston. I used to run out of money and had to change schools. And I took classes in English literature and drama at Harvard since I was in that area.
Mm-hmm. And then how did your career develop, Mr. Krapp? Did you, immediately following your schooling, think of Little Abner and Dogpatch?
No, I created all sorts of tries at comic strips. And then when I was about 19, I was given almost an unheard of chance. I was given a full-fledged comic strip by the Associated Press Feature Service, given to me to do. And I did it for about 3 or 4 months until they fired me and hired some boy who was a year or two older than I was.
They fired you because you weren't good enough
draftsman?
I was incompetent.
It was the only reason. It was discrimination. They were just against me because I had no talent. And I should have rioted, I know. But instead, I went back to school, which is not the way to do things. I realize that now. But at any rate, they fired me and gave a kid named Milton Caniff my job. I don't know whatever became of that kid.
So then, and
I went back to school then.
You went back to school.
Yes,
right.
And a couple of years later, I was really ready, and I then served about a year as an assistant to Rube Goldberg. I worked on Mutt and Jeff, which was a great comic strip of its time. I worked on Joe Palooka, which was another great, and still exists. Mm-hmm. And during that year or so around New York, I became a professional. I simply became a professional by messing up professional strips of other people until I knew my profession.
And how long did it take for Dogpatch and Abner and Daisy May and the whole bunch to get created, so to speak?
For me to create them.
For you, yes. Was this a fast
process?
I
knew exactly what they should look like the minute I sat down. I just knew what they looked like. Mm-hmm. And I knew exactly what their relationships were to each other, and they've just never changed. Mm-hmm.
Now, how old were you at the time, Mr. Kapp?
21. There wasn't any time to wait, you know, not in the 30s.
Has the nature of your cartoon changed quite a bit with, let's say, your becoming more mature
I don't think so. I think that when Time did a piece on me some years ago in which they came up with a line that I'll go with, and they said that the only talent I had was to recognize frauds and swindlers and fakery in every aspect of the life I've observed, and I recognize them and I adored them. I recognize fakery with the greatest relish and reproduce it, and that's exactly what I've done for all of my career is just find fakery, or there's so much of it around. You're embarrassed by the riches of fraud, and you dramatize it.
And another word that occurs to me in reading you from day to day, Mr. Kapp, you use the word fakery. A word which occurs to me is the word minority. You know, you do have, I think, somewhat of a penchant to take up the cause of a certain minority and defend it,
yes,
or at least
is.
Expose it or something like that.
I want to tell you, there's a minority group now. I had an NAACP card long before it was fashionable to have one, when it was fairly dangerous for a public figure to carry such a card. But that fight has been vastly more than one. There is a minority group which is persecuted, reviled, badly paid, and they're killed while they're at work just because they're a different color from other people. They're blue. They're cops. I tell you that we have got to give our cops, these poor blue souls, a chance to live as decently as other people, black and white.
Mm. What keeps you... maybe this is a difficult question, I don't know, but you know, it seems to me if you have to produce this kind of a cartoon story day after day, week after week, year after year, as you have been doing it, does the element of boredom
only among
come
readers.
Into it a little bit sometimes?
Only among my public, not with me. I'm always
not as far as you're concerned.
No.
You are perfectly prepared to carry on with Dogpatch.
No, I'm always in a state of panic. I feel that there are no more stories to tell, but that feeling of panic is what makes every week's work exhilarating. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter with a comic strip whether it's been good for 32 years. The next week it darn well better be better. Mm-hmm. And it better be different, and it's a very exhilarating kind of profession to have, where it doesn't matter what you've done. Simply makes it more difficult if what you've done has been any good at all, because your public expects you certainly to be a little better next week.
Do you consider yourself a writer to any extent, in addition to a cartoonist, if the two can be separated?
It's an odd thing, you know, writers don't consider cartoonists writers because we can also draw. Now, artists don't consider cartoonists artists because we can also write. And so we're penalized for having one more talent than other people. I myself feel that I'm possibly a better writer than I am an illustrator. I'm the best illustrator for my stories. That's as far as I'll go with my own
Now, would you ever write a novel, for instance?
What do you think I'm doing? I've been writing one of the longest novels of all time, but because I also illustrated, you don't know it's a novel.
In daily doses.
Well, what difference does it make if a page, if a daily page of text is this shaped this way or that way? Well, there's no difference at all, is there? And no. People have the greatest respect for prose that isn't illustrated. But if I take the prose I write, also draw some pictures to make it more understandable, it's dismissed as being a very trifling thing. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows that cartoonists are novelists except 80 million readers, and it's a pretty lonely life.
80 million readers. You mentioned the fact just now that you also are printed in quite a few papers outside the United States, right? Mm-hmm. This goes pretty much all over the world?
Yes, and the Iron Curtain countries publish Abner when I have Slobovian sequences, everybody up to their necks in snow and starving and eating each other, they say, this is artist Al Capp's picture of life as it is this fall in New York City.
And they print your cartoon?
Yes, they print it.
Do you get paid for this?
Certainly not.
Rubles and all that stuff?
No. We don't have any deal with them. Our deal is that they can publish anything of ours we do and pay us nothing. We're very stern about that.
That's quite surprising. So there is a certain amount of universal appeal, in other words, to what you do, which transcends the United States as such.
Well,
any
simple characters do. For instance, Tarzan is another one. It's on another level of readership, but it's understood. For instance, I went to Stockholm. I was asked to come to Stockholm by some rather pompous group. Some years ago, to receive some some award, indecipherable award, for some obscure reason, and when I came there, the audience, mainly students, were astonished to find that I wasn't Swedish. They've read my strip for years, which is called Knallhatten in Sweden.
And they thought you were a Swede.
Of course they thought. They knew exactly what venal politician Jackass Fogbound was. They'd recognized all my characters as being Scandinavians. But I guess they're so simple. they just inhabit every country.
Now, we are sitting down here today. This is Florida. You were on a trip. You speak to groups. You go to campuses of universities. You know, you go to the trouble, to the discomfort of travel and all that sort of thing. Why do you do this, Mr. Capp?
You want my answer?
Yes,
because
please.
If I do
yes,
it for
yes.
about 3 days, I come back with about 8,000, 10,000 bucks. Not a bad 3 days pay.
Money, in other words.
Of course. And now, if I told you, because I'm bringing enlightenment to the young, you'd be bored and I'd be lying. If I told you that it was because I wanted to meet young people, that would prove that I was demented. Mm-hmm. Certainly no one confronts teenage students except for a great deal of money.
Didn't you say not too long ago that one of your minority groups, which you hold very dearly, are parents? Isn't that right? Didn't I read that somewhere? Parents?
I've never said a word in sympathy with parents. Certainly not. Not me. No, you're not. I never said a word in praise or sympathy of anybody foolish enough to reproduce themselves.
Uh-huh. Do you understand the younger people today?
Well, I understand my own reaction to them, which my reaction to avoid them.
To avoid them.
Keep out of their way, I tell you.
Dangerous material.
I would, my feeling is that any teenager just applying a key, an ignition key to a car, should be arrested before he gets it started and imprisoned until he's sane, somewhere around 30. Just to preserve his own life. But I do think vastly too much attention now is paid to the opinions of people who haven't been in the world long enough to know what it's all about. This doesn't prevent them from having opinions about it. These opinions should not be listened to. The The student is a subhuman whose father's generosity, the indulgence of the state and the community, all of this is poured into him, hoping that someday he may be useful. Mm-hmm. Now, until he is, I really don't want to hear anything from him.
You know, I had on my mind to ask you, why haven't you ever thought of becoming a politician? But listening to you now, I think I already know the answer, right?
I wouldn't be a Bobby Kennedy type, would I?
No. Mr. Kapp, we don't have very much time left in this. You are regarded, I think, by many people as quite a critic of the goings on the American scene. Now, if you look around you today, can you kind of sort of briefly summarize what the main things are that bother you in the American society today that you like to criticize, that you like to put your pen into?
I think that teenagers deserve more brutality from us than they're getting. They are being deprived of savage treatment. They're growing up without being told to shut up and imprisoned for even crowding the streets. I think if we gave our kids more brutality and less understanding, then we might achieve a really great society.
This is the number one problem as you see it today, then, right?
That's right.
We are too lenient on the teenagers and on the children.
Well, they're our greatest criminal class, and they outnumber us, and they're armed. Mm-hmm.
Doesn't this, though, in some way reflect a little bit the adult, I mean, you and me and the people who are bringing up the children?
I'm not responsible.
You talk about them as
like
a sort
that.
Of an independent little class by themselves.
Well, certainly they have no relation to any civilized group.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Kapp, we could easily go on, I think, talking about
this. I could
this
go on. Not if you're going to talk about teenagers.
Well, all right. Anyway, our brief conversation, I must admit, is drawing to a close. Our half hour is up. I would like to thank you very sincerely. This
great
has been
fun.
A great pleasure to be here. Thank you for taking our time to come
very
to the studios. Thank you, sir.
Point of View with Mark Damon was adapted for radio from a program produced by University of Florida Television. This is George Adkins speaking from Radio Center, School of Journalism and Communications, the University of Florida in Gainesville.